This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
At least seven people are killed as a blast hits a Shia mosque in the southern Afghan city of Kandahar, a week after a similar attack in Kunduz left scores dead. Iran condemns a deadly attack on Beirut's peaceful protest, saying Lebanon will successfully overcome Israeli-backed seditions. Also ahead, the UN says more than 20 million Yemenis are in need of humanitarian assistance as the country's economy is collapsing. Medical sources say at least seven people have been killed in a blast in Afghanistan's southern city of Kandahar. A doctor said 13 more have been injured. A spokesman of the Taliban government's interior ministry said the explosion occurred during Friday prayers in a Shia mosque. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility. This is the second attack on a Shia mosque in the last 7 days. Last Friday, a suicide attack ripped through another Shia mosque in the northern city of Kunduz. The explosion killed more than 50 and injured dozens. A Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility for the attack. The Lebanese army has deployed soldiers to the capital, Beirut. That comes a day after the city witnessed violence during a protest against the probe into last year's port blast. At least nine people have been arrested in connection with the violence. It all began as gunfire broke out during the protest against the judge conducting the investigation. Six people lost their lives, dozens more were injured as a result. The protest had been called by Hezbollah, with protesters accusing the judge of being swayed by the U.S. Reports earlier blamed the Christian far-right Lebanese Forces political party for starting the gunfire and said they had planned confrontation in advance. Now, new reports say Interior Ministry officials have unanimously agreed on the narrative. The Lebanese president has pledged to hold accountable the perpetrators.
What happened will be the subject of security and judicial follow-up, and I, for my part, will ensure that the investigation reaches the truth of what happened in order to hold those responsible and instigators to account.
Lebanese government has declared Friday a national day of mourning for the victims of the Thursday violence. The country's Supreme Islamic Shia Council decried the unrest as an unspeakable crime. There have been reactions from outside Lebanon as well. Iran has condemned the killing of the protesters. It said the Lebanese people, government, and army alongside the resistance will successfully leave behind Israeli-backed seditions. Russia called on all sides in Lebanon to show restraint. The UN urged Lebanese parties to refrain from provocative acts.
Beirut has once again been mired by violence. This time the violence was one-sided. At least six people were killed and 60 others wounded after gunmen shot at peaceful protesters in El Fayouni roundabout in Beirut. The Lebanese army deployed heavily to contain the area and clear it from any armed presence. The Lebanese interior minister stressed that the incident of sniper fire is unacceptable.
We didn't have any intelligence that such an issue will occur. The organizers of the protests had confirmed that the protest was peaceful. The problem began when the first sniper bullet was shot. It was clearly a sniper fire since the wounds were in the head and the martyrs were all from one side.
Hezbollah and the Amal movement in a joint statement accused the Lebanese Forces party of attempting to drag the country into civil unrest, calling on its supporters to show self-restraint. What started as a peaceful protest turned into a massacre against unarmed protesters, whose only crime was denouncing what they see as an unfair and politicized probe into the Beirut port explosion. The popular protest was in tandem with a sit-in by experts at law who demanded that current judge prosecutor in charge of the Beirut port explosion investigation be either removed or that he works by the standards of impartiality, as stipulated in legal standards.
We support accountability against anyone who is in authority and is accused of mismanagement, and they should bear all legal allegations. However, this should be done through the principle of a transparent investigation to uncover the truth and in respect of the Constitution and Lebanese laws and reputation. These victims of the port blast and their families are our families, and we want to uncover the truth more than they do.
Judge Tariq Bitar, the judicial investigator into the Beirut port blast, was accused by several members of the Lebanese parliament of being selective and political in his charges.
There is clear partiality in selecting the individuals he wants to take to court. There were 12 ministers who were in those portfolios. Then why did he only choose 4 from one political group? Why did he select 1 prime minister from 3 prime ministers? Why is the judicial system insulting the legislation council? There is a law that stipulates that members of parliament and ministers are tried in the parliament and not in the judicial council.
Bitar was notified on Monday of a lawsuit regarding his neutrality in the investigation, putting the probe on hold. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
For more in-depth analysis of that story, I'm going to bring in Mohammed Klait. He's a political commentator who comes to you via Skype out of Beirut itself. Mohammed, it's good to see you and have you with us. Your understanding of the current situation?
Basically, the current situation with the detention that has been going on yesterday in Beirut goes back to the start of the investigation into Beirut port blast. And in addition to that, there's also the upcoming election. And every time there's a major event happening in the country, especially elections, there has to be this sort of armed tension in order for the supporters of each political bloc, of each political party, to go back into its ranks. For example, especially that this election in June 2022 is a very vital one for all of the political parties that have been ruling since the 60s. Since in the past 2 years, they have failed, majorly failed to lessen the crisis or the crises that they have made for the past decade, and we are witnessing its outcomes in the past years. They have failed to lessen the problem on the people. They have failed to make any sort of solution. So their popularity has went down. Even after the protest, you have also the popularity even has been damaged a lot after the port explosion because of the political tension that they have created on the investigation, whether they are pro the investigator or they are anti the judicial investigator. And this tension is all about trying to gain more and more votes for the upcoming elections.
All right. Well, the reports, earlier ones at least, like I read in the story, they blamed the Christian far-right Lebanese forces, the political party, for that. To what extent do you share that idea based on your reading of the situation? And, you know, the question, I guess, really is, what do they have got to lose if the, if they see protests happening outside? What is it that they don't want to be seen?
I was yesterday on the ground when the clashes were happening. Several of the people that I have interviewed and I talked to from residents, especially and shopkeepers, there are several sides of the story. Yes, there has been sniper shooting at the protesters who were gathering on the streets that separates the two predominant areas. One that's predominant by the Lebanese forces, a far-right Christian group, and the other is predominant by the Amal movement, who are an ally for Hezbollah. And there has been sniping from the Lebanese forces side towards the protesters who are standing on halfway between both areas. But there is also another story from the people who live in the Amal movement area that have talked about some men and who went inside the Lebanese forces area. They have threw rocks on the Lebanese authorities and threw rocks on certain cars in that area. Maybe it was the trigger, but the thing is that there was a sniper already located and armed. In several snipers, actually, I think there have been four or maybe three, and have attacked the protesters, the unarmed protesters. That raises a lot of questions. And in addition to that, the quick reaction, the quick armed reaction that came out of the Shia area, which is predominant by Amal Mumin, 10 minutes after the sniping, also raises a lot of questions. So basically, both sides knew that there will be an armed conflict, but for what? I mean, I think it was it lasted for 5 hours. Mm-hmm. Six people were dead. Seven people were dead. Mm-hmm. Six of them who were fighting on the ground from one side only, and one innocent woman who was only cooking lunch for her kids who were coming back from school. It was a horrific situation out there. Yes, the Lebanese forces, they hold a lot of responsibility on what happened. They pulled the trigger. They caused all this. They erupted the situation there that has caused the death of seven Lebanese persons. And the rising political and security tension now in the area, all for what? In my personal opinion, as I mentioned before, it's all for the elections. Considering that the popularity of also right-wing Christian groups have descended after the 2019 uprising, the Lebanese forces have been trying to take the place of the Free Patriotic Movement, who has won the majority in the 2018 elections, and their popularity has decreased a lot after the uprising in 2019. They're telling their people, or the Christians in the country, the same rhetoric they have been using when they were part of the Falangist party in the 70s, that we are the only protector for your rights as Christians. We are the only ones who protect your existence in the country. This whole make-believe rhetoric that has been going on since the Civil War is now has been always repeated before any upcoming election.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Understandably. Yes, you would also agree that, you know, there should be a separate investigation only for the events of yesterday once this thing is done and dusted with. I really appreciate your time, Mohammed Clay, political commentator out of Beirut. Israeli forces have fatally shot a Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military claimed the man had been throwing firebombs at cars near a settlement in Beit Jala town in Bethlehem. Local sources say the incident took place during an Israeli raid on the town and that another Palestinian was arrested. This comes a day after a young Palestinian man was shot dead in southern Ramallah. In recent weeks, Israeli forces have killed several Palestinians during attacks across the occupied West Bank. Let's move on to another story now. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a rally in solidarity with the Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails who have begun their hunger strike to protest Israeli authorities' inhumane treatment. Ruba Shabit is on that story in Gaza.
In solidarity with the Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails, Palestinians held a demonstration in front of the Red Cross headquarters in the Gaza city, demanding an end to the recent Israeli strict treatment against the inmates. Following the recent jailbreak of six inmates from the high-security Jabu prison, Israeli regime keeps practicing inhumane policies and increasing abuse against Palestinian detainees.
We are here to send this message to our prisoners that we won't leave them alone in this battle against the Israeli regime. We won't remain silent over the violations of the rights of our inmates in Israeli jails. The international community should make an urgent action to provide protection for our prisoners.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club, dozens of Palestinian detainees from Islamic Jihad have begun the open-ended hunger strike on Wednesday, protesting the Israeli violations and torture inside jails.
Following the heroic escape operation by six inmates, the Israeli regime began to intensify its inhumane torturing policies against our brothers. especially the Islamic Jihad members. Our prisoners have started their hunger strike protesting the inhumane policies of the Israeli regime.
In his speech, the Secretary General of Islamic Jihad, Ziyad al-Nakhala, announced the movement's readiness to respond firmly against the Israeli violations of prisoners' rights, even if this leads to a new round of violence.
We are here today to support our prisoners who have begun their hunger strike. We call on the international community to stop these violations. We warn the Israeli regime that it will face a firm response if these punitive measures are not stopped. Israel is responsible for the lives of our detainees.
About 400 prisoners who belong to the Islamic Jihad movement have begun their hunger strike with the support of other factions. The strike is in protest of Tel Aviv's inhumane measures against Palestinian prisoners, intensified following the escape of 6 inmates from a high-security Israeli prison last month. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Iraqis protest against the results of the Sunday parliamentary elections amid reports of voting irregularities. Different factions have objected to the initial results that saw a bloc headed by influential cleric Muqtada Sadr coming first with 70 seats. The Fatah Alliance rejected the results as fabricated. After reports of fraud, Iraq's Electoral Commission started the manual counting of a portion of ballots, which has changed the results in some districts. Final results are yet to be announced. No single political bloc has won a majority in the 329-member parliament. Yemen's humanitarian crisis is worsening, its economy collapsing. That's what the UN Deputy Humanitarian Chief has said as he addressed the Security Council. Ramesh Rajasingham has also said the conflict in Yemen is growing more violent. He said more than 20 million Yemenis are in need of humanitarian assistance. That amounts to two-thirds of the population there. The UN official said aid agencies are now helping more people than before, pushing back the immediate risk of large-scale famine. But he warned the agencies would face problems as they are once again starting to run out of money. As a result, he said up to 4 million Yemenis could see their food aid reduced in the coming weeks. Yemen's been ravaged by a Saudi war that began in March of 2015. And that's it with international news.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
As the world recovers from the consequences of the coronavirus pandemic just before the arrival of the winter of 2021-2022, demand for fuel is surging, and so are the prices of oil and its products. The world is encountering an energy crunch as the supply of energy sources is failing to meet demand. Natural gas prices have risen several fold in Europe, while several factories in China have shut down recently due to power outages linked to the short supply of coal. In the UK, meanwhile, many fuel pumps are shut off and the country's military has been called in to overcome any violence. India's power plants are also running on critically low coal stocks. In the United States, people are dealing with natural gas prices that have gone up 47% since the beginning of August, and the energy crunch has caused oil prices to hit 7-year highs. These circumstances are causing central banks and investors to worry. Rising energy prices are adding to inflation, which already was a major issue with the global economy trying to recover from the continuing effects of COVID-19. Dynamics over the winter could make matters worse. In the meantime, two countries with some of the largest hydrocarbon reserves in the world, Iran and Venezuela, are under U.S. oil sanctions. For further analysis of this situation, stay with us on Iran Today. Why in recent weeks has demand increased for energy conduits, in turn increasing their prices? Mr. Joe Carr was appointed in charge of the International Energy Studies Institute last month. Let's hear his take on the matter.
In general, the price increase is due to the imbalance that has occurred in the market since September and October, when there has been a shortage of 1.1 million, 1.2 million and 900,000 barrels of supply in the market respectively. This naturally leads to an increase in price. Now the point is, what is causing this supply shortage? If we look more closely at the market balance, on the one hand, the demand has been soaring as the COVID-19 pandemic is being restrained. On the other hand, increased demand for petroleum products due to a hike in gas prices and shortage of natural gas in the market has increased the demand for oil.
Since energy prices impact economic policies across the supply chain, the rise in prices has had a significant effect on economies, with many companies in Europe and Asia shutting down, unable to bear high energy costs. Analysts have attributed the rise in global energy prices to several factors. Some see the rise as driven primarily by the bounce back witnessed in consumer demand as economic activity returns to normal after the pandemic. Production, however, has failed to bounce back as quickly due to distributions to the supply chain caused by the pandemic. Other analysts see the rise in energy prices as an example of greenflation caused by increasing restrictions placed by governments on traditional energy sources. Mr. Hosseini is an economic activist in the petrochemical sector. He's always got plenty of input for us, so let's give him an ear.
The incident which has affected oil markets is a shortage of LNG gas, because the world could not have predicted that things would go back to normal this fast, and it appears that it didn't plan for the winter season. On the one hand, the demand has risen dramatically, and on the other hand, natural gas cannot be supplied as easily as oil. Also, Russia hasn't delivered surplus shipments to the European market in recent months. Now, if we want to calculate the oil price based on the gas prices, it must be somewhere near $180 per barrel. This has caused concerns.
Oil prices went over $80 a barrel this week for the first time in 3 years, with natural gas and coal also reaching multi-year peaks. The Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries is planning to meet shortly to decide whether to free up spare production capacity to help control prices. Mr. Soltani is an energy economic expert. His opinions come with conviction, and I invite you to hear that conviction.
OPEC and OPEC Plus are very cleverly and wisely managing the global oil market in proportion to their long-term interests and not necessarily to the detriment of consumers. However, they are concerned about the outlook for the oil market and, given this concern, are trying to manage and control the supply of oil to world markets. And this is all despite some irrational expectations and also pressure from the United States and some other industrialized countries.
Additionally, Iran and Venezuela, two founding members of OPEC, have inked an oil contract to counter the sanctions the United States has illegally imposed on both nations' oil exports. As the South American country seeks to boost its oil exports in the face of U.S. sanctions, it has agreed to a crucial contract to swap its heavy oil for Iranian condensate that it can use to improve the quality of its crude. The swap agreement is planned to last for 6 months in its first phase, but could be extended. To what extent does boycotting big oil producers, such as Iran and Venezuela, increase prices and decrease demand?
The Trump administration was in favor of sanctions because it wanted to find a market for its oil and gas under its energy dominance strategy. If that didn't happen, the U.S. increased supply would result in an imbalance and the prices would drop as a result. That scenario would prove damaging to the U.S. energy dominance. In case the prices went up, American consumers would be at a disadvantage. That's why Trump had reached a price range of between $45 to $65. The Biden administration published its national security strategy in March 2021, in which it explained the system it's going for is one favoring the transition towards renewable energies. This new system brings a new serious threat to the prices.
A Chinese logistics firm is going to play a key role in the supply of oil from Iran and Venezuela, even after it was blacklisted by Washington 2 years ago for handling Iranian crude under the sanctions regime. This highlights the limitations of Washington's system of restrictions, analysts say. According to Julia Friedlander, who is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Geoeconomic Center, these types of events show there are limits to what the U.S. sanctions can do, especially when you target multiple like-minded or selectively like-minded actors like oil traders. So you incentivize these alternative axes of resilience. China maintains normal, legitimate trade with Iran and Venezuela under the framework of international law that shall deserve respect and protection, China's foreign ministry said in reply to inquiries about the role of Chinese companies in the trading of sanctioned fuel, adding China strongly opposes unilateral sanctions and urges the United States to remove the long-arm jurisdiction on companies and individuals. U.S. officials typically do not move to intercept Iranian or Venezuelan oil shipments bought by Chinese or any international customers. But they do make it difficult for those involved in the trade by barring U.S. citizens and companies from dealing with them, making them outcasts for Western banks.
In the previous government, some expressed wonder at why India refuses to buy Iranian oil, complying with sanctions and orders by the U.S. But we have to ask this question, why should they buy Iranian oil? To answer this, we have to discuss our marketing strategy. The sanctions must become the problem of our customers and not us. We have made the sanctions our problem because of our strategic viewpoints and actions or inactions in the face of the sanctions. Indians were asking themselves why they needed to buy oil from Iran in 2018, considering the figures from the year before when they purchased 8.1 billion euros worth of Iranian oil but paid back 1.4 billion euros worth of products. Right now, they consider 1.4 billion euros of products in exchange for 8 billion euros of oil not a bad deal. But if that number was something like 6 billion euros, would they stop buying Iranian oil that easily? They would be pressed to ask the US for sanction waivers as Iraq and Turkey did.
Energy supplies are likely to remain limited for a while, as it takes time for producers to boost their output in response to higher demands. The crunch is expected to get worse if a severe winter increases energy demand further. Much will also depend on how governments on either side of the Atlantic react to the current crisis. As it stands now, countries are already trying to outbid one another for supplies. It could get a lot more competitive when temperatures drop during the winter. The current energy crisis in Europe is an alarming sign of what's to come for the rest of the planet in the coming months. Predictions tell of a sharp rise in global demand for fuel this winter. Can Iran make use of this opportunity in spite of sanctions?
In fact, Iran is deprived of the benefits of the rise in oil prices. If there weren't any sanctions and Iran was able to sell its oil as easily as it could in the past, it would be a great opportunity for the Iranian economy to make up for its shortages caused by a halt in exporting oil and lower oil prices. But the sanctions continue to cast a shadow on the Iranian economy, preventing the country from taking advantage of the current uptick in oil prices.
Until a couple of months ago, it was not very important for the world that Iran is under sanctions because supply exceeded demand. But the current trends in the global market may put pressure on consumer countries, European countries, and countries like India and China, or U.S. allies to push the United States to lift sanctions. Of course, part of this depends on what OPEC countries decide, because they still have a capacity of several million barrels to increase production. If these countries agree under U.S. pressure to increase their output, the prices will certainly not remain this high. But if these countries are not ready or capable for any reason to increase their output, or if they are not willing to give in to the pressures, we can expect a price increase of up to $100 per barrel. At that time, these hikes could definitely affect the sanctions on Iran and Venezuela.
More on what can be done to alleviate the global energy crisis after a quick diversion into world media.
Hello and welcome to the news part of the show with me, Sarah Adema. As a fuel crisis is taking the world by storm, today we will look into some reviews from different media outlets regarding this global issue. Our first review of the day comes from the New York Times that reads, "A scary energy winter is coming. Don't blame the green politics." Several forces are coming together that could make Vladimir Putin, the king of Europe, enable Iran to thumb its nose at America and disrupt European power markets enough that the upcoming UN climate conference in Glasgow could suffer blackouts owing to too little clean energy. Blame COVID-19. First, the pandemic erupted and signaled to every major economy that we were headed for a deep recession. This sent prices of all kinds of commodities, including oil and gas, into downward spirals. But the economy snapped back thanks to government stimulus programs far faster than anticipated. And so too did demand for energy. But this industry does not ramp up quickly, so there was not enough natural gas, let alone renewables, to fill in the gap. Secondly, with major oil powers such as Iran and Venezuela under sanctions, it seems that the U.S. has played a major part in creating this crisis for itself and its allies. Moving on to another review from Al-Monitor writes, "Oil minister says Iran capable of resolving global fuel crisis." Iran's oil minister said, "If sanctions targeting his country's lifeline crude are lifted, the Islamic Republic will have every capability to tackle the world's energy supply shortages." The Iranian oil minister Javad Oji declared, "Iran is ready to resolve the ongoing fuel crisis in the world and make up for the shortages." To that end, he said the United States ought to lift onerous sanctions that have targeted the Islamic Republic's vital oil industry. OG made the comments following a virtual meeting of the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, or in other words, the OPEC. His statement referenced fuel shortages, which have hit the United Kingdom particularly hard in recent weeks amid soaring prices and long queues at petrol stations across the country. The Iranian minister advised Western decision-makers to learn the lesson and help with the crisis by lifting unlawful and unjust sanctions on Iranian crude. Our final review of the day comes from the Interpreter that begins with the headline, "Iran's Energy Diplomacy." Much is made of Iran's support for freedom fighting groups in West Asia, but far less is made of its use of power of the energy kind, exemplified in its use of its energy exports to take advantage of regional states' inability to cater for their own domestic requirements. In neighboring Iraq, for instance, Iranian gas and electricity powers more than a third of the country's energy needs, particularly in the south. So reliant was Iraq on Iranian energy that former U.S. President Donald Trump had to carve out an exemption from his policy of maximum pressure sanctions on Tehran lest the Iraqi grid collapsed. Tehran also exports electricity to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Turkey, although in the case of Turkey, pressure from Washington and its own political desire to diversify its energy providers has seen a recent drop-off in energy imports from Iran. But it is in Lebanon where the role of energy in expanding Iran's soft power has once again been highlighted. Iran is always alert to opportunities, understanding the energy cards it holds, despite the economic constraints it operates under. Tehran has shown it is willing to play its hand in regional relations. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you in the next edition of the program. And until then, stay safe and bye-bye.
In recent years, Iran has shown that even under oil sanctions, it has been able to export its oil through alternative methods, albeit less so. Recently, the first of several truck convoys carrying Iranian fuel was shipped to Lebanon via Syria. The fuel delivery has been characterized by the Lebanese group Hezbollah as a huge boost to the country, which is in desperate need of fuel. This was only the first of four Iranian fuel tankers scheduled to dock in Syria's Baniyas port shortly. Oil Export Monitor Tanker Tracker says the four-tanker shipment contains a total of 33,000 metric tons of gasoline and would need 792 trucks to deliver the entire shipment to Lebanon. China is also among the few nations that are importing crude oil from the Islamic Republic. Iran's oil exports have dipped under the harshest ever U.S. sanctions that were reimposed 3 years ago after former President Donald Trump abandoned Tehran's 2015 nuclear deal with leading world powers. Iran was the fifth largest crude oil producer in OPEC in 2020 and the third largest natural gas producer in the world in 2019. It holds some of the world's largest deposits of proved oil and natural gas reserves, ranking as the world's third largest and second largest reserve holder of oil and natural gas, respectively, in 2020. At the end of 2020, Iran accounted for 25% of oil reserves in West Asia and 12% in the world. Despite its abundant reserves, Iran's crude oil production has fallen since 2017 because the oil sector has been subject to underinvestment and international sanctions for several years.
What to a worst-case scenario?
Iran must consider the worst-case scenario and see how it can move towards neutralization of the sanctions and not their removal. The removal of sanctions means engaging in talks like the 2015 Iran nuclear deal to suspend the sanctions, a move that carries a high degree of uncertainty. This is because the suspension of sanctions has to be confirmed every 6 months by an executive order from the US president, which involves a certain degree of uncertainty. The Islamic Republic must move towards the neutralization of the sanctions, something that the current administration in Iran is pursuing. This means we have to nullify the effects of the sanctions.
Although Iran is a member of OPEC, it is exempt from the production cuts under the OPEC Plus agreement because its crude oil production remains limited by U.S.-imposed nuclear-related sanctions. Iran's crude oil production reached a 30-year low in 2020 as a result of these sanctions and the impacts of the global COVID-19 pandemic. EIA assesses that Iran's production could return to full capacity at 3.8 million barrels per day if the United States lifts oil sector sanctions. Iranian oil production is now about 2 million to 2.5 million BPD, with around 2 million BPD allocated to domestic refineries and roughly 500,000 BPD to exports, a source close to the oil ministry said. Iran and the leading world powers have been in talks since earlier this year to revive the nuclear pact and have held several rounds of negotiations, which have been inconclusive so far. Iran remains hopeful that it would be able to reinstate its oil production to pre-sanctions levels once the sanctions are lifted by the U.S.
Increased demand for winter occurs mainly in summer because oil purchase contracts are long-term contracts of 3 to 6 months, and purchase and sale contracts for most of the oil supplied in winter and cold seasons are made and arranged in the previous month. So the effects of the entry to the cold seasons have already been felt, and if there are any purchases or sales, they'll before the coming warmer seasons. Therefore, the effects of cold seasons on the global oil market and the increased demand, and in turn increased prices, have already been felt. We are already experiencing the results of those factors.
Despite all difficulties like the coronavirus pandemic and U.S. sanctions, the Iranian oil and gas industry has been developing at a rapid pace. Various sectors of Iran's oil and gas industry, including exploration, production, processing, and distribution, are all among the world's top rankings, and the country is taking new steps to develop the industry even further. To what extent would you say Iran's oil industry is independent? Is it sufficiently so?
They can also push for the lifting of these sanctions. For example, Turkey and Iraq. Iraq has a contract with us for another 2 years. Turkey has had a 25-year contract with us, which is now getting expired. But if these events had not happened in the gas market, and they could have replaced LNG. Right now, the Turks are one of the buyers of LNG from the United States. They have tried to cover their shortages by buying LNG from Qatar and the United States. Now that prices have risen so much, they all seem to be interested in renewing their long-term contracts with Iran. On the other hand, the high prices of gas put pressure on the demand for petroleum products. Now many power plants that have been using gas are likely to prefer to use petroleum products as gas prices soared.
Among different sectors of this industry, refining is a major one which is seriously attractive for development. According to OG, the country's daily oil refining capacity will increase by 1.5 times to 3.5 million barrels in the near term. Besides its huge crude production capacities, Iran is also a leading supplier of natural gas with a current production of over 1 million cubic meters per day. Therefore, gas refinery development is also being pursued as a high priority. Beit Boland Refinery in the southwest of Iran is an outstanding example. The refinery, which was inaugurated in mid-January, has a daily processing capacity of more than 56 million cubic meters of associated gas, and when operating at full capacity, it will generate $700 million of revenue every year. As the largest gas refinery project in West Asia, Beit Boland will have an annual production capacity of 10.4 million tons of methane, 1.5 million tons of ethane, 1 million tons of propane, 600,000 tons of gas condensates, and 500,000 tons of butane.
Speaking of self-sufficiency, there are several issues to consider. One is the products, in which case we can confidently say that we are self-sufficient in refining and producing gas and petroleum products. In terms of self-sufficiency in the engineering of oil projects, construction, pipelines, drilling, making offshore platforms, and so on, we are in a much better situation compared to other oil producers. We are in an acceptable position when it comes to equipment, too. There are 700 to 800 Iranian companies that are manufacturing oil industry equipment and have taken some very good steps.
That's all for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same time next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام: عالم ينتفع بعلمه أفضل من 70,000 عابد.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The knowledgeable man who is beneficial to others as a result of his knowledge is better than 70,000 worshippers."
Back, dear listeners, it's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam has beautiful conversations. He has these beautiful dialogues, if you will, golden conversations with his friends, his companions, his relatives, and the people in general. And in many of these conversations, he talks about these Islamic code of ethics, these Islamic codes of conduct, of course, which have been given to humanity by the creator of humanity, Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. And the purpose of these Islamic ethics, these Islamic codes of conduct, these etiquettes, this akhlaq, as it is known in Arabic, is in order to perfect humanity. Now, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, in one of these conversations, he was asked about a beggar and this concept of begging. And so Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he says that if the beggar knew what was happening while he was begging, he would never beg anyone. And then he continues, if the person who is being begged knew what was happening when they turn away this beggar, they would never turn away anybody. First and foremost, dear friends, what is most beautiful about this tradition is the fact that Imam al-Baqir is talking to us about both sides of the coin, not just one. He's talking about the beggar, and he is talking about the person who is being begged. Now, as far as the beggar is concerned, Imam al-Baqir very clearly here explains that begging in itself is not something which is recommended. Begging is not something which is honorable. Begging is not something which is noble. Matter of fact, if you are to beg anyone, you should beg Allah. But you should never beg somebody else, you know. For example, we see in some modern westernized countries how you will find people on the streets, begging for money, sitting on the corner, or they have a can in their hand, again, begging for money. This is a very dishonorable state. Requesting for help is a different thing than begging. Requesting for help is not something that is disliked. And on the other hand, it says that if the person who is being begged knew how bad turning someone away is, they would never turn away anybody. So if somebody does come and does beg you, don't just kind of shoo them off, you know. at least if you don't have any money to give them, at least, you know, say something in charity. May God help you. Or, I'm sorry, I don't have anything on me. Or, again, may God help you. You know, may God alleviate your problems. May Allah bless you. Even this form of charity will suffice. Beautiful words in this dialogue. Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha
illallah. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
So Egypt was the main manufacturer of paper during those days, during the early days of Islam. And the way it was being done from before, that, you know, there would be a trademark on the paper produced from Egypt. The trademark was not an imprint, rather it was an embossed symbol. Nobody really bothers to see what is it, until the days of Khalifa Abdul Malik bin Marwan. This is the days of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. He became curious one day and he said, you know, on this paper that we get from Egypt, what is the symbol that we see? And somebody translated for him. And the symbol basically said, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And so he sent instructions to the governor in Egypt. He said, you know, this should be changed. And instead of that, they should put the symbol which says Shahid Allahu an la ilaha illa huwa, that Allah testified that there is no God but Him. And so this was done. The news reached to the emperor in the Eastern Roman Empire. Although Egypt is no more under their control, Greater Syria is not under their control, you know, but the master sitting there says, you know, we can't tolerate this. This is our symbol. So initially he sent an ambassador to Damascus to Khalifa Abdul Malik with some gifts, you know, using the diplomatic approach that we would like you to revoke your decision and let the symbol be the way it was before. And the Khalifa, you know, just refused to accept the gifts and did not respond positively. The ambassador came second time. Again, same thing happened. Third time when he came, Basically, the third meeting came with a threat that if you do not revoke your decision of changing the symbol on the manufacturing of the paper in Egypt, then I'm going to mint coins, gold coins, which will have some insulting remarks about your prophet. So this is a threat now being given to the Muslim ruler. And when Abdul Malik bin Marwan faced this threat, he didn't know what to do. He asked his advisors. Nobody was able to come with a good solution to that until one of them, by the name of Ruh bin Dhanba, was kind of inclined towards Shiism, knew our imams. He says to Abdul Malik bin Marwan, because these are from Banu Umayyah, you know, they knew Makkah and Medina. They knew Ahlul Bayt anyway. And he says to the Khalifa, إِنَّكَ لَتَعْرِفُ الْمَخْرَجْ مِنْ هَذَا الْعَمْرِ وَلَكِنَّكَ تَتَعَمَّدُ تَرْكُ. This advisor says to the Khalifa that you know the solution to this problem, but you are avoiding that source. And he says, what do you mean I'm avoiding that? you know, whom are you referring to? And he says, عليك بالباقر من أهل بيت النبي. If you want the solution for that, you refer to Baqir from the Ahlul Bayt.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.